The Athletic.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
It's the Fulhamish podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC. My name's Sammy James. Welcome to the show, brought to you by The Athletic UK. And it is the Thursday Club. And we're going to be looking back at Saturday's horror show up in Coventry and maybe a bit of a wider analysis of exactly what went wrong and also what has gone wrong in the latest month for Fulham. It's not been plain sailing at all. If August was a breeze, then it was very much choppy waters during September and early October. We've also got a bit of a discussion today on Matt O'Reilly following Peter's piece in The Athletic. And also, we might be looking a bit at Claudio Ranieri, who is back in England following that famous, very unsuccessful stint at Fulham. And as I said, it's the Thursday Club today, so I'm joined by Jack Collins.
Hello, listeners.
And Fulham writer for The Athletic, chief Fulham writer for The Athletic, Peter Rutzler.
Hello, Sammy. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Been a while since I've given you your full title, so I thought
it's very much appreciated. Thank you very much.
Right, let's get into it, chaps. Coventry on Saturday, an absolute abomination. Not what any of us were expecting, I think, when we didn't cruise into halftime 1-0 up. It certainly all seemed quite comfortable and routine. Peter, a flick of a switch and that match suddenly was 4-1.
Yeah, it was that 5-minute spell after half time that just seemed to whack Fulham around the head, and they never recovered from their sort of days that resulted from it. I mean, it set up to be one of those away performances, and I think, as you guys described on the Monday podcast, it was set up as one of those sort of get the job done performances. You know, things weren't going particularly well in the first half. It was quite finely balanced. Fulham had a threat. Coventry had their moments as well, and they were doing very well, getting into wide areas. O'Hare in the middle was causing a few problems, but I felt Harrison Reader sort of got to grips with him by the middle of that half. And then after half time, it was as though Fulham had stayed in the dressing room mentally, and it was just they were out there in physical form, and they were just blown away. The mistake, obviously, for the first goal was important. And then when you compound that with the penalty as well, two very different scenarios. One in very much self-inflicted. The other, it was a dive. The FA have now charged Matt Godden. If proven, he could get a 2-game ban now for diving, which is kind of a weird thing to get a harsher punishment than what you would have got on the field. But
yeah, let's talk about that. I was incensed by the dive, and I said on Sunday's podcast that I felt that like the wider narrative around this game was not centered enough on the dive, because it was all lovely Coventry City have got a big win and they did a great comeback, and it probably also because it was 4-1 as well, and maybe as well there's another reason it glossed over. But yeah, to see Godden get a 2-game ban for that, in some ways I'm applauding it, but I was definitely shocked.
Yeah, he hasn't got it yet. It's obviously got to be proven, but I mean, it looks like it will. I mean, it was a dive, and I do think you're right, Sammy. I do think it was a massive part of the game. Obviously, afterwards, you could see Marco Silva was very unhappy with the decision. But didn't want to lay the blame on the door of the referee. And to be honest, you can't really. For sure, it was a big moment in the game. It compounded the first mistake, but I think you have to take the two together. You have to take that mistake, the Paolo Gazzaniga pass, which is a poor one. Tim Ream's touch is then poor. And then Josh Onomar, I'm not really sure what he's doing there. I think he's trying to rectify the situation, and it just all looks terrible. And when you have two such incidents, then you're going to it's a problem. And then the concerning thing is how they responded. And that for me was still the main takeaway. It's how you respond to those moments, how you deal with that, because there are going to be other moments like that this season. I mean, there's been hardly a game gone by without a major refereeing decision that seems slightly off. And you've got to be able to cope with that and manage through it. And Fulham didn't do that.
Yeah, Jack, your analysis from Cov at the weekend. What I would love to know is, do you think this is a blip? Do you think this is a one-off and just it was a lot of bad circumstances and a bit of poor tactics, poor management from Silva that led to what happened in Coventry? Or is this a slippery slope?
I don't want to say it's a slippery slope, but I think that's probably jumping the gun a little bit. I think there are some recurring issues that I would like to see fixed quite quickly. We're struggling against the high press with wing backs away from home. We saw it at the second half at Bristol City. We saw it against Coventry, especially in that second half. When people really put the put us under the cosh, especially away from home, we're really struggling to get out. We're really struggling to fight our way out of these situations, and it's hemming us in a way that I didn't see Fulham being done it. And basically isolates the middle. It means that we have just Harrison Reed basically in there trying to play his way out and not being able to find any solutions in possession. And basically we're getting stuck in our own half, and it means that our possession sequences are short. It means that we're not able to hold onto the ball. It means keeps coming back at us, and it puts undue pressure on a defense, which whilst I would say is not a bad defense by any stretch of the imagination, is a defense which I think is being coached to want the ball, to possess the football and then break out and be able to dictate games and really move Fulham outwards. And I think it was quite obvious against Coventry that as soon as you put them under sustained pressure, this defense is a bit like, hang on, we're not used to this. We actually like controlling games. And Fulham had zero control in that second half. I think that's the terrifying thing about the Coventry game. It was the first time this season I've seen Fulham completely lose control of a game. Now, it happened in fits and starts at Bristol City. We were still the better team in that second half. I thought we opened them up a couple of times. We were unlucky in not to score again, one, and two, to concede a goal that was miles offside. But yeah, against Coventry, you weren't unlucky. You know, yes, you can talk about the decision for the penalty all you like, but ultimately, Fulham had an opportunity there to grind out a result. We shot ourselves in the foot with the first goal, with the equalizer. Yes, it happens to the penalty and we can see that it's a dive, et cetera, but you bounce back from that. If you're a side with, a strong core that's able to deal with these situations, Fulham capitulated, absolutely capitulated. And that is going to be a worry for Marco Silva looking forward, because suddenly you're going to go to places, especially if Fulham are a scalp, which we are in this division, which we are having Mitrovic, which we are looking at the squad that Fulham have put together. We are a scalp. We're going to be a target for teams, and other fans are going to be like, come on, we could beat Fulham. That'd be a massive result for our season. And I'm not playing the Billy Big Bollocks here. That's not what it is. It's about the fact that Fulham are expected to go up top two by pretty much every other side in this division. And so to beat Fulham on your own patch is a massive achievement. And therefore, you look at it and you go, people are going to be up for that. They're going to be game. And we basically capitulated in front of a home crowd that was vociferous, that made it a little bit nasty in there. And look, there were plenty of things that I'm sure we're going to talk about, I'm sure we're talked about, that, were unsavory and for quite frankly, horrible at what happened at Coventry. But the team on the pitch being able to respond to and not respond to, probably more importantly, that kind of environment, that kind of atmosphere, and being put under the cosh is a little bit scary. I'm not going to jump the gun and say this is a slippery slope, because I think it can be rectified, but I think it needs to be rectified quickly.
I mean, that performance is the most alarming of the season. And I'll start with the tactical point, because it's really interesting, because this is, I think you could even throw in Birmingham City into this. And I know the result was 4-1, but all three of the teams Jack mentioned, so Coventry, Bristol City and Birmingham, at some point in their games used a 3-4-1-2. And it literally just goes man for man with what Fulham are trying to do. It puts someone on the number six, stops them playing out slowly in a pedestrian sort of way. So if you're not on it, if you're not with it, then you will get pressed very, very quickly. And when you press high, the wing backs can then push onto Fulham's fullbacks, and suddenly it's very difficult to break out unless you go direct. I feel like that's something that Fulham have stopped doing so much. You know, I mean, in the early couple of games, I'm sure we remarked a few times about, they want to get forward quickly, turn the other team around. And that seems to be a simple way to do that. But at the moment, it looks like Fulham have one set way of playing and they can't really adapt. From the way Silva talks and how he talks about his idea and his model, he has a very, very set formation. He has a very set style, and that's how Fulham are going to play. He will tweak it compared to who they're up against. They'll try and find the spaces, exploit certain areas. But from the get-go, there is a 4-3-3 there. There is a number six, normally one. And then the only real change is whether it's a 10 or an 8 and how advanced those midfielders sort of go. So that makes you almost predictable, or at least you can plan in advance. You can do what Coventry City did. You can do what Bristol City then adapted to and actually set up to counteract them. Football's not one of those games where you go, this setup will naturally counterattack this one. It's not like that. But if you're not playing at tempo, if you're not on it, if you're not able to recycle the ball quickly, I mean, some of the passes, even in the first half, were appalling between the midfield three. And when you're not on that, and the team can press high, they can take the ball off you and they can exploit you and they can pin you back. And as Jack said, Fulham lacked control in that game. Now, that's just one side of it. And then, of course, there's the reaction too, where you have a team that has got to get used to that kind of pressure. Jack's absolutely right. Fulham are a scout. I know we can dispute the actual mechanics of the finances that Fulham have spent and, you know, how much they're spending this year or how much they're going to It's irrelevant. Yeah. The narrative is very clear. Fulham have committed to spending around 20 million. Now, Silver's disputed that, whatever. Either way, it's far more than anyone else in the division. Yeah. You know, they're a Premier League team, maximum parachute payments, an incredibly strong squad. You're going to be a scout. You're going to have to cope with that. Teams are going to come up against you and say, right, this is our big game. This is our one game where we think, we're underdogs here. And it was a great atmosphere, to be fair, at the ground. And it just felt like Fulham just fell apart under it. You know, the weather was crap. It wasn't playing the way they wanted to. It wasn't nice. The football wasn't tidy, pushed high and punished Fulham.
And Jack, you wanted to mention one Coventry player in particular who did give us the runaround, I felt like, on Saturday, which was Callum O'Hare. He was a bit ineffective in the first half, but second half came into his own. Tidy little player.
Yeah, really, really good player. And he's interesting. We spoke about him on Ranks this week. I had Ali Maxwell on, and we were talking about players that potentially have the ability to play in the Premier League, if not next season, then definitely the season after. And Callum O'Hare's name came up. He's a pressing machine in that 10. And I think it goes back to all what we were saying. You know, this formation isn't Fulham's kryptonite. Do you know what I mean? There's plenty of teams that can play a 3-4-1-2, and Fulham will be able to play around them with their eyes closed, right? One, Fulham looked like they were running in mud. Which is not a particularly pretty thing to watch. We just looked like we were very, very sluggish through the whole game. And two, O'Hare basically sat on firstly Harrison Reed and then John Mikel Seri when he came on and hassled. And that in itself took Fulham by surprise. We've seen Seri play his way out of some pressing this year, but I would say pressing that was three-quarter hearted at most, right? It's one of those things where you look at it and go, okay, John Mikel Seri is able to do this flick. He's not able to do that if Callum O'Hare is breathing down his neck before he even gets the ball. And I thought that was a massive part of why Fulham weren't able to get out, because our six is so important in terms of how Fulham play, the metronomic ability of John Mikel Seri. Obviously, he was missing from the start of this game, but you can understand that Fulham have other players that can play this role. I do appreciate that while Seri is unbelievable and has been all season, we have to be able to rotate. It's a long season. We know his legs have given out before. We know he's playing international football again for the Ivory Coast. So he's not going to be able to play every single game. But, you know, we do need to think about who goes into that role, especially in games where they're going to be under pressure from moment one. If you've watched any of Mark Robbins' commentary from this season or before, you'll know that that's what Callum O'Hare does. You know, they're basically, is the only position he can play as a 10. That's all he can do. He never plays wide. He never plays up front. He always plays the one, the 3-4-1-2, or they don't play him. And so you can look at that team and go, you've got to be ready for that. And Fulham just didn't feel ready for that. And that worries me a little bit.
Part of me does think though, Peter, that as much as I think there is real things to address here, and it did seem like Fulham came unstuck against the Coventry system and just the way that they pressed and a kind of fervent home crowd, that we will get a little bit of normal service resumed in the next few games. I know that they're getting much, much tougher, the matches, but there has to be an element of, I felt that there did seem a bit of one-offness to this, that it was a unique set of circumstances. It all absolutely capitulated in front of us in circumstances that I don't think would happen 10 times out of 10 in that game against Coventry. It all did go a bit wrong. I think there's things to go like, okay, this Fulham side is not infallible, and there was a bit of a blueprint from Coventry there. There aren't going to be many teams in this league who are going to be able to replicate what Coventry did.
I think you're right in terms of how that second half sort of unfolded. It was pretty unique, that start. I don't think Fulham are going to get a 5-minute spell like that again. We'll have to see. What was perhaps, I guess, less unique, but still what is concerning is just the reaction, because that's going to happen again, almost certainly going to happen again. There will be moments where the pressure will increase. There'll be games where Fulham are pressing to try and find the winner when the game is tied. We think back to the Bristol City game where Fulham reacted quite well. They were able to create opportunities. Cabana missed a good chance, and Mitrovic obviously in stoppage time. So that was almost encouraging. However, they lacked composure. They lacked a calmness, is what Silva described it, to actually stick the ball in the net. Now, that's not too dissimilar to what happened against Coventry in the second half. When things were going wrong, there was a distinct lack of composure in the team. You know, they created nothing. They didn't test Simon Moore. That was deeply concerning. So, for sure, I think you're right in terms of how the second half unfolded, and I don't see that necessarily happening every week. Yeah. But without doubt, in terms of how they respond to the reaction, how they respond to adversity, that's definitely going to happen. That's going to happen all season long. And then that's why it was probably the first game where you've gone, hold on a minute, this is not good. This is something that we need to really keep an eye on, because if it happens, it keeps happening, Fulham won't get into the top two places. It's simple as that. Now, obviously, the Championship is a wide open division. The results are crazy. Fulham are still, 2 points off the automatics? So. Yeah. We can't be going that this is a crisis, and even the underlying metrics are still really good. You know, like you can't disguise the fact that most games Fulham have been really very impressive. They do play some good football. You know, they score a lot of goals. They create a lot of chances. I'm looking at the stats in front of me now. Highest expected goals, among the fewest expected goals against, some of the most shots in the league, four fewest shots conceded. I mean, the story's still okay, but I think after this period, after this international break period between September and October, you know, it sort of reset expectations and also laid out some clear markers that have to be kept an eye on, because those qualities, those, I guess, mental qualities really, can be decisive when you're chasing automatics.
I guess, Jack, one result that Fulham haven't really had, and West Brom have definitely had it, and Bournemouth had it a little bit, but not quite so much, is a result where we've dug out a win. All our wins, I feel like, this season have been kind of achieved in third gear. You think back to the run in August, and, you know, the win at Birmingham was a fairly comfortable one. There hasn't been a game this year, and there was obviously opportunities against Reading, Bristol City, and, well, particularly against Coventry, not that we even got close, where Fulham actually were put under adversity and should have been able to find a way to get 3 points. And you look at a couple of West Brom's wins this year, the one at Peterborough, 0-0 going into the 90th minute, bagged a 94th minute winner. You look at their win away at Blackburn, where Blackburn made it 2-1 at the beginning of the second half after West Brom were 2-0 up at halftime. They held on, still managed to get the 3 points. And I think that's maybe what Fulham need in the next 2 or 3 games. And look, we've got games where we probably will have to do that kind of win, is we need a win where actually it's not necessarily, look, if we win every game 3-0, I'm not going to be here complaining. But also, I think we need to get a result kind of not out of nothing, but we need to get one out of adversity a bit.
I mean, I suppose we dug out the win against Millwall in the end. We shouldn't have had to, but we did.
I get what you mean. There was a 5-minute spell, maybe, but it's not exactly like.
And it wasn't particularly cohesive either, right? There's that element of it. I get what you're saying. I do think that there are going to be games, especially if Fulham hit gear, you know, or hit top gear, should I say? You know. It's a very different thing. If we hit top gear, they're going to have an element where we can tear through teams and score a couple of goals in a couple of minutes, right? It's what we saw at Swansea at home. It's what we saw at Huddersfield away. You know, we are able to just absolutely blitz teams when things start to click for us. And actually, that's not a bad thing to have in the tank. You know, when you score one, you often score a couple, and as things go, I think it's a pretty standard way of looking at how Fulham are going to play this season. Yes, I appreciate what you're saying in terms of, you know, we need to dig a few out, but ultimately, I do think there's enough quality in this side that when we get there, we're gonna be fine. And once this international break comes through, perhaps it's just like that bit between the breaks, right? Between the breaks is terrible and a bit scary, and then we come out the other side of this international break, and things are just exactly as they were beforehand. So we shall see. But I'd like to see here. I think for me, the big thing is that Silva learns the lessons of the first international break, that we get to go and see, you know, a bit of a time here where the squad get together and just reset their heads. We don't see mass changes coming out of the other side of the international break, but we do see enough changes just to freshen the players up who haven't been away. The weird bit on that, I suppose, is a lot of calls for Marek Rodak to come back in, which I think are completely fair enough. He's obviously away for the international break while Gazzaniga's here. That's not great for him, I'd imagine, in terms of actually trying to secure a spot within the side, pushing forward. So there's that element to consider. But on the whole, you know, the talk is that Kenny Tete might be back after the international break. The talk is that Fabio Carvalho might be back after the international break. We might see Marco Silva's full team restored to him. And in that case, I think things will get slightly easier.
Yeah. Peter, there has been talks of Tete and Carvalho after the international break. You don't know for certain. Do you feel fairly confident that one, if not both, might be back in that side for the Rangers game?
I'd be more confident that Fabio would be involved after the international break. I'd be surprised if he's not at this point. Yeah. But, you know, I think Silva in his press conference said that Kenny Tete could be available after the international break. That I imagine he'd probably need a little bit more time just to get up to speed. But, you know, both of them are pretty close. So, and as Jack says, having one or both is a big boost. And obviously, throughout this period, Fulham have missed them. Fabio Carvalho, yeah, probably in particular, and it's probably his off ball work as much as what he does with it that's been missed.
And Peter, one disappointing thing that followed up after the game, you wrote about this in the Athletic's news section, police investigating after a Fulham fan reported racist abuse at Coventry. There's only so much that we can say because it's an open investigation, but if true, a really horrible footnote to the afternoon.
Yeah, certainly really disappointing if true. And you know, as I understand it, you know, it was reported at in the ground, and the police investigating in Coventry have been helping. So we'll see what develops from that. It's a shame because the day itself was quite a nice one. Obviously, it was Jimmy Hill Day. Obviously, the fans met by the statue at the front, and it was absolutely pouring with rain. Still came out, still wrapped a couple of flags around the statue, and it was a real shame, to be honest, that the second half performance played the way it did. Because it would have been quite nice to sort of frame the match story around it, shall we say? But unfortunately, it didn't pan out that way. Yes.
And on a similar tangent, just a little bit of a show of solidarity for our friend Russ Goldman over at Cottage Talk. I noticed that there were a section of Coventry fans who were giving him some pretty nasty abuse on his YouTube review of the Fulham Coventry game, pretty much just for being American. And I just thought it was particularly out of order, given that everything that Russ has done, been doing Cottage Talk for 10 years. He really very much is the OG when it comes to Fulham podcasting and Fulham broadcasting, and, you know, never nice to be on the receiving end of that kind of abuse. So just all our love, Russ.
Cause, yeah, big love, Russ.
Yeah, all us Fulham fans know how much you care about this club and football in general. So if you're listening, Russ, then stay strong and keep going with the great work. All right, we're going to take a break, and afterwards we're going to discuss Matt O'Reilly.
This is an advertisement for BetterHelp, a portal for finding online therapy. How's your social battery right now? If you feel a bit drained or lacking enthusiasm to meet all the social commitments in your life, then that can be a totally normal thing, especially with things picking up as we head out of winter. I know that pretty frequently a weekend just doing a few chores and watching the football was about the limit of my energy resources, but therapy can be a place to help you gain the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your batteries. Contrary to popular belief, therapy isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma. The overall goal is to empower you to be the best version of yourself. And if therapy therapy is something you've considered, then why not give BetterHelp a try? BetterHelp is entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. They'll match you with a UK mental health professional with a wide variety of expertise. There's no referral needed, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge, giving you complete control over the whole experience. Fulhamish listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/fulhamish. That's betterhelp.com/fulhamish. Part two of the Fulhamish podcast. Sammy James here with Jack Collins.
Hello, listeners.
And Peter Rutzler.
Hey, everybody.
Peter, a piece out in The Athletic this week that you released on Tuesday, an interview with a certain Matt O'Reilly, which I know will pique the interest of Jack Collins, who was very much banging the Matt O'Reilly drum for several years. And the interesting story about how he turned down a contract offer with Fulham to go as a free agent, and in the end has joined MK Dons, joined them initially under Russell Martin, and is really thriving in their system in League One. It was a brave move from Matt O'Reilly to go without a contract, but it seems to have worked out brilliantly for him in the end. Couldn't help read this with a tinge of what could have been.
Yes. Yeah, no, it was actually something I put to him at the end of the interview, and maybe in different circumstances, Matt O'Reilly would have pushed into the first team at Fulham. But you know, as he said, it's ifs and buts. But he was a player, once I started covering the club, that immediately came up in comments and questions about what had happened to him. Because obviously he went without a club for 6 months. Essentially he said he was training in the park for a bit. Once it was decided that he wasn't going to extend his contract, you know, for that extra month into lockdown, Scott Parker called him and said, look, I don't want you around in the setup. I think the same thing happened to Luca Della Torre, who we spoke to last year as well, which Matt accepted. And then it went from there, really. I think he had a trial with a Belgian club in December, but it was Russell Martin that had shown that interest and taken him into the fold. But a really, really interesting conversation, actually, and a really relevant one. It brings up a lot of topics about the academy pathway. Of course, for O'Reilly, in the time in which he was breaking into that first team, Fulham were getting promoted to the Premier League in 2018-19, then went straight back down, had multiple changes in management, which is just not the ideal situation for a young player. I remember when we were talking at the end of last season about potentially Scott Parker going and what that might mean for the young players, because it means you have to prove yourself again. Now, it's been fortunate that Marcus Silva's come in and has really, really taken to some of these academy players and brought them into the setup. And obviously not being in a pandemic has helped. But, you know, it makes it very challenging. And to be honest, and when you read what he was saying and listening to him at the time, he's a confident kid. And it was evident that, you know, fair play to him, to be honest. You know, he wanted to go and get game time. He wanted to make sure he was playing, because he'd been around that first team setup since he was about 16. And he's gone out and he's done that. And as you say, Sammy, he started really well at MK Dons. He's played in every league game. And I think he was their player of the month for August, the club's player of the month for August. And he's among the highest performing midfielders in the division now. So I don't think it'll be long before he's stepping back up a level.
Jack, have you got a little bit of a case of hate to say I told you so?
A little bit, but I mean, look, ultimately he's made that decision himself, right? It's not a decision that I don't think anybody made for him. And it's a strange one, isn't there? There's always those questions over why Matt O'Reilly left and why he was excluded and why he didn't play more. And there's always going to be those questions at Fulham. And I mean, I know that certain members of the Twitter brigade will tell you that he had the wrong agent and therefore wasn't able to play for Fulham. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's part of the same agency that has Joe Bryan, Josh Onuma, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not quite sure it's that. But there is a question mark over, you know, not signing that contract and not doing it. While I appreciate the first team football point, and I think he's spot on in order to go and kick on and move into that, there's always that question of, was his mind kind of taken by those articles that said, oh, Dortmund are after Matt O'Reilly? You know, do you remember all of this, the whole thing that he was linked to Dortmund, if I'm not mistaken, a couple of Serie A teams as well, interested in potentially signing him. And then he became a free agent and nothing of these popped up. And there was a little bit of chat that had he been swindled in some way to think that there was more interest in him than there actually was from abroad. So I'm really glad ultimately. I loved watching him in for the youth teams. I thought he was a phenomenal player. I thought he was a real talent. And I loved watching him for the youth teams, and therefore I'm delighted for him, to be perfectly honest with you, to go away and make your mark at MK Dons. And I know he'll be under Dean Lewington there, and who's a good guy by all accounts, and seems to be a good place for players to come through and work. And look, he's worn the armband on a couple of occasions, I think, if I'm not mistaken, MK Dons, which is pretty impressive for a kid of his age to be coming through and doing that in a team of, well, some seasoned professionals in that side. So yeah, I mean, look, yes, there is an element of I wish he was playing for Fulham, because I think he's good enough. And again, he's another one we talked about with Ali this week, as he was Ali's League One long shot, that he thinks he's potential Premier League quality. So there is a player there that we all think that, you know, that he's able to deal with the physicality, the kind of mix it ability in a league as physical as League One. He's got no problems mixing it with them in that division. He's got 2 goals, 2 assists in 7 appearances this season, if I'm not mistaken. And therefore you're looking at this and going, right, this is a very, very impressive player at that level. And at 20 years old, to be running games in League One, you don't think it's going to be long before he makes a step up at least one division, if not two. And I would be very surprised if we didn't see Matt O'Reilly playing in the Premier League at some point in the future. But Peter, I think the bit that was most interesting for me was his point about nationality.
Yes, yeah, he's got... he was actually born in Singapore as well. I did ask if he was eligible for Singapore, but I don't think they'd be on his radar.
Does he know if he's got any Irish grandparents? Because we could really do with him.
He didn't mention.
Sound like he should.
He didn't mention that. But no, he's eligible for Denmark through his mother, Gita, and Norway through his mum's father, so his grandfather. But of those countries, I think the decision will be between England and Denmark. Obviously, he's played at youth level for England. He says he feels Danish. So he speaks a bit of Danish, has family in Denmark. So that'll be interesting to see. He said he celebrated both goals in the Euros, which, you know, I think that's a bit questionable, but
that is questionable.
England played Denmark. But no, yeah, so that's one decision. And I think Jack's right in terms of where he could go. I mean, Blackpool came in from in the summer. So already there are clubs looking at him to take him back to the level Fulham are at now. So, you know, it's an interesting one. I thought it was also quite interesting how we talked about not just the players that were in his way because of signings that had come in, but also how he played as a six and he didn't really want to be a six. And he felt that his game was a bit more rounded than that. He's actually playing quite a little bit deeper at the moment with MK Dons, but with that license to get forward too, which he really likes. So, it'd definitely one we'll all be keeping an eye on, I'm sure. And even from a Fulham perspective, you know, the academy still benefits when these players do well. He comes back in their ratings. Financially, there's an element to it. So to see him do well is a good thing for Fulham, as much as you would like to see him in the first team.
I just can't wait to watch Denmark with a midfield pivot of Thomas Delaney and Matty O'Reilly. We're like, are you sure, lads? Like, is everybody feeling all right?
I you say it's good for Fulham, Peter, and I can understand that there will be small benefits, but it's not the same as if he does make it to the Premier League, then Fulham will have effectively just watched another Premier League quality youth player kind of walk out the door for nothing. And I just feel like we're massive victims of the volatility of Fulham's league position. If Fulham were even solid Championship or solid Premier League, some of these players may not have gone under the radar. You've seen that article where Matt O'Reilly says he's thinking, okay, it's the summer of 2019, maybe this is my shot to get into the first team. And he talks about how then Fulham signed Harrison Reed and Harry Arter in his position, and he's going, well, they've got 200 Premier League appearances between them under their belt. They're like, I'm not getting into that team. And whilst I can maybe understand the signing of Harrison Reed in hindsight, because he's absolutely mustard, the signing of Harry Arter, that is one of those signings that you must come in and go, he was all right for us. He did a bit of a job. He scored a couple of great goals. But if you could ask me in hindsight, would have I rather seen 20 appearances from Matt O'Reilly that season or the 20 appearances from Harry Arter? It's kind of a no-brainer. And I guess it's the academy falling victim of the short-termism that is kind of required for Fulham to get back to the Premier League, which is the number one above all else aim.
Yeah, no, there's no denying that. That's fundamentally why you would get Matt O'Riley leaving and other young players thinking and assessing what the pathway is like. It comes into the same thing in terms of changing managers too. I mean, it all plays a part in the thinking of a young player. And you're right, Sammy. If there was more stability, I don't think there's any sort of debate around that. Even this season, you know, Marco Silva's pushing for promotion. It's a massively important job for him. He's a new manager. Sure, Fabio Cavalli has done well, but he seems to be a talent above and beyond. And it feels like you've got to be that level. You've got to be sort of Ryan Sessegnon level to actually get in and get those opportunities. I guess it comes down to what the club want to do, really. And I can understand why there are then questions of, well, what's the point when, you know, you bring in those players. But again, which is why I mentioned about, you know, there are some good benefits of him doing well, in the same way that whenever a young player comes through the academy and is in the Football League, that reflects well on the club. But at the same time, the purpose of the academy is, you know, outwardly, it's actually to produce Premier League and Champions League quality players. That's their sort of remit. But from a Fulham perspective, you know, there's nothing better than seeing a young player in the first team. And if those pathways are blocked by new arrivals, it makes it difficult.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, if you want to read Peter's article and interview with Matt O'Riley, and I suggest it's well worth your time, you can get 33% off a new subscription to The Athletic by going to theathletic.com/Fulham Pod. Right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to discuss our favourite Fulham Italian manager. Part three of the Fulhamish podcast, Sammy James here with Jack Collins and Peter Rutzler. Jack, you wanted to dispute my claim just before the break.
Yeah, not my favourite Fulham Italian manager.
He's not mine either.
Does Vincenzo Montella not count? Like, obviously he didn't manage Fulham, but he's an Italian manager who also played for Fulham. But I feel like that should count.
Maybe. I mean, I'd obviously rather have Vincenzo Montella managing Fulham than Claudio Ranieri any day. So yes, I guess it counts. I mean,
I'm having it.
Claudio is my favourite and my least favourite because he's the only one. But he is back in the Premier League, Jack.
Yes, he is. He's at Watford. He's taken over from Zisco, who was fired by the Pozzos after, well, 6-7 games of this Premier League season. So, I mean, look, it's a lot of people will look at this and go, Watford doing what Watford do, right? But you'll look at the majority of the Watford fan base and they're pretty happy with it. So I don't think they're all that happy with Ranieri coming in as his replacement, but I think they all basically wanted a change. So, I mean, look, who are we to argue? If Watford fans wanted a change of management, then we should let them have a change of management.
Peter, if people are interested as to why Watford have gone for Ranieri, there's a piece from Adam Leventhal on The Athletic, which I know that you contributed towards from a Fulham perspective. Given that his time with us was so disastrous, it does feel like an odd move. I guess he still has some credibility in the bank from what he did at Leicester City, though.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it carries a long way. I guess it depends on the circumstances, I suppose. It's different. I think, as it was put in the piece, it's kind of difficult to fully assess him at Fulham in the sense that you can't make a full sort of general picture of what his management style is because of the situation you sort of inherited with the squad that was massive, you know, the massive turnover the squad had, the massive change from Jokanović to a Ranieri style of play. It was always going to be a bit of a challenge. Never really seemed to warm to the squad, I think, was the concerning factor. And I think when he has that public face of being, you know, very nice and a nice person and a very amiable character, you can lift a team. That probably will be Watford's concerning point, but, you know, different set of players. So, I mean, if you base it on his 106-day spell at Fulham, I wouldn't have the loftiest expectations, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And I think that when you look at what he had at Fulham and the squad he inherited from Slavisa Jokanović, Ranieri was a, well, I think given the last few years of his kind of management style, Leicester onwards, he's a reactive counter-attacking manager, right? That's what we've seen him do in those things. Obviously, it was a little bit different when he was at Chelsea early on and whatever, but over the last couple of years, we've seen him really in a reactive side who don't want possession, who wants a counter, you know, whether that quick or slow, mostly quick. And we've seen what that can do for him. And we saw it at Leicester. It didn't necessarily work for him in France. It worked a little bit better at Sampdoria, where he was able to make it kind of work. And it was an absolute disaster at Fulham. That said, he basically tried to put a side who loved having the ball under Jokanović and wanted to play free-flowing, expressive attacking football into a 5-4-1 with Alexander Mitrovic up top, and somehow thought this was going to get goals. It didn't, funny enough. And it basically, there was a few questions saying, surely a great manager should be able to adapt to the side he has in front of him and deal with it. And I agree. I think a great manager does. I don't think that he's a great manager, personally. I think he's a good manager. And he's obviously won the most iconic Premier League victory, I think, in history, probably ever. But on the whole, I think he's a manager who will be able to get his sides to a tune out of his sides if they are built in the right mold. Now, I think that Watford, with Ismaïla Sarr and his pace on the counter, with the amount of centre-backs they have in there and the fact that he's probably going to use Craig Cathcart again, it means that this is a better fit for Ranieri stylistically than what Fulham was. And I think that's important to remember. That do I think he's going to keep them up? Probably not, no. But do I think he's going to do a better job with this Watford side than he did with Fulham? Yes, because the side is built much more to his taste than I think that Fulham were. And Fulham fans as well, bear in mind, wanted to see that expressive attacking free-flowing football under Jokanović because it was fun. We loved it. It was really enjoyable. I don't think Watford fans will have the same desire to watch a certain stylistic type of football because that it has been so chop and change over these years. And there is that factor that managers kind of come and go. I think that Ranieri will have a better time at Watford than he did at Fulham.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for listening to the podcast today. We will have a podcast for you early next week, hopefully Sunday or Monday, talking about the Craven Cottage atmosphere. We're going to have Tom Greatrix from the Fulham Supporters Trust, Dom Betts from the H5 crew, and also we're going to be speaking to a Norwich fan who has been instrumental in improving the atmosphere at Carrow Road with the Along Come Norwich initiative. So it'd be great to hear from him as well. We're going to be getting into some of your questions that you've been sending in via Twitter about the atmosphere as well. So hopefully it should be a really, really interesting podcast that will be out early next week. But us three will return at the same time next week, previewing that big QPR game, reacting to the latest Fulham news and probably reviewing some of the international performances from various Fulham squad members who will be playing for their nations this weekend. Last thing to do is to thank my guest, Jack Collins. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sammy.
And Peter Rutzler, thank you.
Thank you, Sammy.
All right. Take it easy, everyone. Have a good weekend. Without Fulham spoiling it, come on, you whites.
You whites.